From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. In the entire history of the United States Supreme Court, there have been only four women who have served as justices, three of whom are serving now. Aside from Sandra Day O'Connor, Sonia Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Elena Kagan, no women have ever served on this most important of government institutions. Now, a new book explores the lives and careers of those women who have been shortlisted over the years to serve on the court and asks what sort of judiciary and country we would now have had some of these women actually been nominated and confirmed. My guest is Hannah Brenner Johnson. She is Vice Dean for Academic and Student Affairs and an Associate Professor of Law at California Western School of Law in San Diego. And she's the co-author with Renee Kanaki Jefferson of the new book, Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. Welcome to the program, Hannah.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So broadly speaking, let's start with this question of why there have been so few women on the U.S. Supreme Court. Is it essentially, you know, basic sexism, misogyny?
Well, it certainly is not the case that there have not been a large cohort of immensely qualified women who could have served on the nation's highest court. But I think that the Supreme Court of the United States is in many ways emblematic of the entire legal profession, which, although has seen an influx of women and minorities over the last decades, has still not seen those individuals occupy positions of leadership and power in that profession. So I think that, yes, to your point, there is some sexism at play.
The latest two Supreme Court justices to be confirmed were both men, Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch. I suppose, unsurprisingly, nominated by, you know, essentially a white male supremacist president. And rather than try to undo some of the damage to the court from having so few women serve on it, he just nominated two more white men to the court. But it was the nominations and confirmations of Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan by President Obama that you say inspired this book. Why start with them rather than Sandra Day O'Connor?
So it was actually the year in between the nominations of Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan to the court that inspired this entire project. Renee and I were new colleagues at Michigan State University College of Law, and we were paying attention, as many of us were, to those nominations. In the year between Sotomayor and Kagan's selection to the court, we were struck by the way that the media focused on things that we didn't think were very related to their qualification for a position on the Supreme Court. Things like what they were wearing during their confirmation hearings, whether they had children. Several media articles lamented that they didn't have children, that in fact the Supreme Court needed more mothers on it. And so it was in fact those two women who were considered and then ultimately confirmed to the court and the surrounding discourse around those confirmations that really inspired us to take on this project. I think for many people, mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You point out that people thought it was so bold and courageous of President Obama to nominate not one but two women to the court. This, an institution that, as we've mentioned, only has ever had four women Supreme Court justices. And at that time,
yes,
it would have been just one or two.
Absolutely. I think much of the discourse around the Supreme Court and gender focuses, perhaps rightly so, on Sandra Day O'Connor, who of course was the first woman to break through the glass ceiling and be appointed to the court in 1981. But as our book points out, there actually is a very rich history and tradition of women being considered for the court dating all the way back to the 1930s. But of course, none of those women were ever selected.
So, Hannah, you looked at nine women who were shortlisted for Supreme Court nominations before Sandra Day O'Connor was nominated and then confirmed under Reagan, right?
So President Reagan obviously gets credit, a lot of credit for selecting the first woman to serve on the court, Justice O'Connor. And there were other women who were considered alongside O'Connor, as well as subsequent to her. So Reagan's track record in selecting other women and minorities to federal judicial positions was not quite what one would have expected, given the bold move that he made in putting O'Connor on the court.
So we often hear of presidents who come into their positions with short lists of potential justices. It's a way for a president to have an indelible mark well beyond their presidential tenure on, this incredibly important federal government institution, the highest judiciary in the land. And so the women that have been shortlisted, let's go through some of them. You point out the first shortlisted woman was a woman named Florence Allen. Tell me who Florence Allen was.
So Florence Allen was a judge in the state of Ohio. She was actually the first woman to be put on a federal appellate court, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And she was a trailblazer. As you might imagine, a woman in the judiciary in the 1930s was almost unheard of. So Allen was considered actually by three different presidents, dating back as far as President Hoover. In digging through the archives of a number of the presidents, that's how we, in fact, identified who many of the women who appeared on presidential shortlists actually were. And so we came across Florence Allen's name in President Hoover's papers, on a list of others that he was considering for the court. And the same is true for President Roosevelt. And then subsequent to that, President Truman also considered her. She obviously, blazed trails and was selected for a lot of positions of leadership in the course of her career, but never made it onto the nation's highest court.
So there were all of these women shortlisted before Sandra Day O'Connor was nominated and confirmed. These women you point out in your book, I mean, there was a point of your book, I imagine, to show how well qualified they were. Would you say that in some cases they might have been even better qualified than their male colleagues who ended up on the court?
Absolutely. We find that women, not just in history, but also today, often have to be just that much more qualified in order to even be considered, much less selected. And when you place the resumes of these women adjacent to the resumes of the men who ultimately were selected, who were moved off the list, and onto the court, they rival those qualifications. They went to the nation's best law schools. They worked for and were appointed to the highest federal circuit courts. They had positions in government. They were active in their communities. They were a cohort of incredibly qualified women.
You point out the other women that have been shortlisted over the years before the very first woman, women like Soya Menshikoff, Sylvia Bacon, Mildred Lilly, Carla Hills, and Cornelia Kennedy. Now, most of these were white women, right?
Yes, there was only one woman of color in our study, Amalia Kearse. And Amalia Kearse was an African American, is an African American woman and judge. She was one of the first women who broke into Wall Street and worked for large law firms during early in her career. Is now a circuit court judge. And perhaps not surprising, but in fact, we were somewhat shocked that there was only one woman among the nine who had been shortlisted, one woman of color among the nine who had been shortlisted in those years.
And of course, Sonia Sotomayor became the first and so far the only woman of color to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. So, what were some of the considerations that you could tell around why some of these shortlisted women never made it onto the court. Was much of the discourse private, or was some of it public, you know, in the papers, such as the discourse around, the more recent discourse around Kagan and Sotomayor? What were the conversations, both private and public, if there were any, around why the shortlisted women before Sandra Day O'Connor never made it onto the court?
So there's a lot of different explanations and themes that we pulled from the archives and from the history and from all of the research that we did. You know, sometimes it was a president putting a woman forward because there was a lot of political pressure to do so. President Nixon never had any intention of putting a woman on the court, but was certainly pressured by a lot of individuals, by organizations, by the public. And you know, for others, it came down to perhaps their age. But I do think that I think that the pervasive sexism, the pervasive bias really underscored whatever explanation may in fact have been put forth. So you mentioned Mildred Lilly. Mildred Lilly was a judge from California who, you know, at this point in history, historians, politicians, and others have gone back, compared her resume to others who made it onto the court. And certainly she rivaled many individuals who made it onto the Supreme Court. But the undoing of Judge Lilly was really the American Bar Association. President Nixon submitted her name to the ABA's Standing Commission on the Judiciary, Committee on the Judiciary, and that committee rendered her unqualified. It was a committee that was made up largely of white men, and I think it was clear that the at least the people who were occupying positions of power in the legal profession at that time in the early 1970s certainly were not ready to put a woman on the court. But we observed, even in the way that many of these women were written about in the media, just the pervasive bias that they faced. So the article actually that we discovered about Judge Lilly in the early, that was published in the early 1970s in the New York Times, focused on what she looked like in a swimsuit and noted that it was fortunate that she did not have any children, as wow. if these things somehow made any sort of a bearing on whether she would be a qualified Supreme Court justice. So it was this article actually that spawned our inquiry and our query about whether there were other women who had been shortlisted for the Supreme Court. But you know, I think it's on the one hand easy to chalk up an article like that that was written in the early 70s as something that was just, you know, reflective of the sexism of that era. But of course, even fast forward to 2009 and 2010, during the when Justices Sotomayor and Kagan were being considered for the court, they of course were critiqued about things that mattered little to whether they would make good justices on the Supreme Court.
Was there discussion around a fear that having more women on the Supreme Court would, broadly speaking, potentially lead to American women in general gaining more rights at the expense of men?
So I think that fear certainly underlies, for example, why the Equal Rights Amendment may not have gotten traction back in the day. And, you know, I think that, you know, to the extent that seeing women in these powerful positions may in some way threaten what was the status quo, at least among middle class and upper class white women who were in the home and men were, you know, in the workforce. I think there was probably a threat that underpinned some of the pushback that women received.
So going through this history, what are some of the ways in which you envision our court, our Supreme Court, and our country might have been different had some of the women who were shortlisted before Sandra Day O'Connor actually made it onto the court?
Well, if you take in total the cohort of 9 women who were shortlisted and you look at their perspectives, their background, where they came from, where they went to law school, what their careers focused on, it's a very, very diverse group of women. You know, in no way are we advocating for one monolithic way of judicial decision making. We think a court is richer for its diversity of individuals who sit on it and who serve in that capacity. And so, you know, it's not a stretch to think that if Florence Allen had been put on the court in the early 30s, maybe some of the cases that the court would have selected to take on and review might have been different. We also think that there's a great power in being visible. And we attribute a quote to Sandra Day O'Connor, who talked about the first step in achieving power being visibility. And so, you know, seeing a woman on the court in the early 30s or the 40s or the 50s or even the 60s might have inspired other women to consider a path like that. But without representations of people who look like us in positions of leadership and power, it's often hard to gain any traction and really make any significant inroads or significant change. So, you know, to the extent that having women on the court, you know, may or may not have had it would have had an impact on the writing of judicial opinions in the way that, you know, having a different cohort of justices would. But it also would have sent, I think, a very powerful message about what's possible to others.
So between Sandra Day O'Connor being nominated in 1981 and Ruth Bader Ginsburg coming next, you know, over 10 years later, from 1993 to 2009, which was when Sotomayor and Kagan were then nominated. So that decade or so of time, there were no nominations of women. But then there was a woman named Harriet Myers, whose name came up during George W. Bush's administration. Tell us a little bit about Harriet Myers, whose name might not be familiar to younger members of the audience.
Right, but certainly familiar to those who would have been tuned into the politics and the court at that time. She became a very polarizing figure. But Harriet Myers was, again, an incredibly qualified attorney. She had worked in the White House. In many ways, her tenure in the White House really was a very long job interview for a position like Supreme Court Justice. But we really believe that she was subject to a lot of gendered scrutiny, a lot of discrimination, and you know her resume interestingly illustrates a phenomenon that we talk a lot about in the book, and that is about double binds, or double standards. So you asked a question earlier about whether the women who had been shortlisted were as qualified as the men who sit on the court, and I answered in the affirmative. Harriet Myers illustrates how something that is a benefit to one justice or one potential nominee may be something that's used against her. And she was in fact discredited in part because of her leadership serving as the president of the Texas Bar Association, where there are other examples of people who have men who've served on the court who occupied very similar leadership roles. And that was heralded as sort of an accomplishment. So Myers ultimately withdrew from consideration for the court, so we never actually, you know, she never made it onto the court, but certainly could have, and we really think that a close scrutiny of what happened during that era really does reflect this persistent and pervasive sexism.
As someone who's studied this issue now greatly, would you agree that the only course of action to right the incredible, pervasive, centuries-long gender injustice on the Supreme Court is to have 9 women serve on the court for a few hundred years?
Well, there have been a lot of people who are, you know, more credentialed and well-known than me who have advocated for such an end. And it is interesting that our book features 9 women. It was not an intentional book, but certainly one that we think is, you know, a lovely coincidence. You know, I think that the diversity of experiences and the diversity just represented in these 9 women really reflects the importance of having more women on the court, whether it's 4, 5, or 9. Having just one a token really doesn't go very far toward the end of equality. So I definitely would be in favor of many more qualified women being considered and then selected off of the shortlist and put on the court.
Do you think that the era that we live in today, that has been dubbed the hashtag MeToo era, where women have, you know, filled enough positions of power that our collective voices in saying, you know, no more, have gained enough traction? Perhaps it's because we have just enough women working in the media now and working in positions of power to refuse to let go of the pervasive sexism that we face, that the Supreme Court, you hope, might reflect this new era going forward?
I certainly would like to hope so and think so. I mean, we certainly have made a tremendous amount of progress. But I think that in our current era, I think in some ways we suffer a little bit because the discrimination and the bias isn't so evident. So many of the women that we write about in the book literally had the doors to law firms, and in some cases law schools, slammed in their faces. They were not hired because they were women. And obviously we've come so far since then. But the bias that persists, the subtle forms of sexism, I think in some ways are more dangerous because they're harder to see and to identify and name in the way that very explicit and overt discrimination could be named. And so I guess I'd like to think that we've passed a milestone and we're heading in the right direction, but obviously, as you mentioned earlier, you know, in our most recent opportunity to put new people on the Supreme Court, it seemed like it was more a preservation of the status quo than a reflection of this new era that you allude to.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Hannah. Let's hope that Ruth Bader Ginsburg hangs on until there's a new president and that the next few Supreme Court justice nominees are indeed more reflective of America. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and for highlighting this important book and this important conversation. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Hannah Brenner Johnson, Vice Dean for Academic and Student Affairs and an Associate Professor of Law at California Western School of Law in San Diego. We've been discussing the book that she co-authored with Renee Kanaki Jefferson. It's called Shortlisted: Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.